Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with independent artist Dawn Richard, whose 2021 album Second Line is one of our favorites of the year. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, we've got some new music.
That is a little bit of a track called Bitter Streets from the new album by Sault, S-A-U-L-T, the fifth of its career. Greg, you had the two releases from last year, they came as a pair. Untitled Black Is, Untitled Rise, as your number one album of the year. They were on my top 10 as well. Who is Sault? I wish I could tell you. We don't know. They have been against saying who the group is, who the driving forces are. We know a couple of names that have been associated. The producer, Inflow, Dean Josiah, Chicago rapper, Kid Sister, and a great R&B singer named Cleo Soul. There's a rapper named Little Sims, Michael Kiwanuka. Fantastic R&B artist we've talked about several times on the show. But is Sault all of them? Is Sault some of them? Are there other players to be named? Who knows? They dropped this album on June 25th. It is called Nine. They have said on their website, you've got 99 days from June 25th to enjoy this album. That gives us till October 2nd. Yeah. Now, it's available for sale as a download. It's available for sale on vinyl, and it's streaming everywhere. I think the vinyl, presumably, and your download will not self-destruct, but maybe they're going to pull it off streaming services in 99 days. Let's play a song from this album and then talk about the music, because that's what is important. London Gangs from Sault. The album is called Nine.
London Gangs, when your soul is tight, it's all built on lies. Now you're here for life. You only know venom, so you're here for life.
That is London Gangs from the new Sault album, Nine. Incredibly prolific group. Jim, as you mentioned, I loved the twofer, because they really talk about it as the same, as one and the same in terms of presentation. Untitled Black Is and Untitled Rise from last year. And those two records, I think, spoke to the year that we just went through and the period era we're living in one of the most moving and powerful fashions of any music released in the last few years. This was a broad look at the Black Lives Matter experience, what it means to be a person of color in a world where you're not always, very rarely welcome.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they're talking about it in terms of resilience. In other words, hearkening back to a lot of the messages we heard during the civil rights movement in the 60s, where we're going to get through this. It's really a struggle, but we're going to find a way through. On nine, they're being more specific. They're drilling down into their experience in Britain, growing up as a person of color in England. And that specific experience, they're talking about what it means to grow up on those streets in particular. London gangs, trap life, fear, you know, you from London. You know, they talk about these kind of ideas of, you know, hey, here you are, a person of color in England, what's that like? Again, the music is incredibly diverse. Inflow is a brilliant producer, and the way he's bringing in the black music experience and tying it together with black music, which is basically the foundation of basically every important musical form of the last century.
I think we need to delineate that, Greg. What are we talking about? We're talking about R&B, we're talking about soul, we're talking about hip-hop, we're talking about gospel, we're talking about trap music, we're talking about psychedelic funk in the great maggot-brained Parliament funkadelic tradition. Essentially, the entire spectrum of the last half century plus.
It's all there. And they talk about gang life, and you know the perspective from the outside about gang life is this is evil, these people are criminals, they're thugs, and they're saying, well, there's a reason these gangs exist.
Yeah.
Is because people of color feel they got to gather together in some kind of organization, some kind of community to protect themselves because death is around the corner. You know?
Straightforward paths to business success are not always open to them.
Absolutely. And I think this record addresses that very directly. You mentioned Lil Sims. She talks about, I know killers in the street, but I ain't really involved. We don't want to cause any grief, but we get triggered when hearing the sound of police.
I know killers in the streets, but I ain't really involved. We don't want to cause any grief, but we get triggered when hearing the sound of police.
If you are a person of color, even if you're not involved in a gang or in crime, you are somehow touched by it because somebody you know is, somebody you know has been harassed or worse by police. You know, it's that experience. You know, when they talk about bitter streets, they're trapped. You know, and it's interesting how they use the word trap life. That is ghetto music in America, right? In here, it's trap music, but it's also you are trapped in this life. How do you get out? And at the end of the album, they talk about a pathway out, but it's a moving experience. This group is incredible. They're making just incredible music year by year. And when we look back on this particular point in the 21st century, we'll be referencing Salt's music to explain what was going on.
Well, and we'll be doing it without any hype whatsoever. I mean, the fact that in this age of social media oversharing, that we're not even certain beyond those names I've thrown out. I mean, maybe it is Inflow's entire project, and maybe it isn't. Maybe there are names that we don't even know, right? Yeah. And they don't care. What they want to keep the focus on is the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be out there for 99 days. Yeah. Hop on it now. You know, nine is an important figure. Nine is a gun, right? A 9mm. And there is a lot of talk about guns. People may wonder, given how heavy you describe this album as being, why I chuckled when you said You From London, that song. It's really funny.
Yeah.
Oh, You From London? I'm going to be real with you. I had no idea. But you know what? I love Europe.
Despite it being about London gangs, about the streets of England's toughest areas, I think there's a universality in this, Greg. You know, Mike's story, I will say once again, it is a less than 1 minute, 57-second spoken word piece featuring somebody named Michael Ofo talking about how he learned of his father's death in violence on the streets.
I remember I started crying because my mum was crying. Because I could feel her pain. I didn't know what was going on, but I could feel her pain.
I am not a big fan, as you know, of the skits that sometimes are dropped into R&B and hip-hop albums. But that really is contextual, because this is an album, I think, about mourning the lack of opportunities, about mourning violence, about mourning, you know, why some people turn to drugs and alcohol. Yeah. That track, Alcohol, is just fantastic. It's just a really powerful human album. I don't know, can we call it the album of the year when it comes to December?
Because it was
only available. Here? Was it here for a whole year? I don't know. Anyway, October 2nd. Move on it before then.
In the summer of 07, I was sure I'd go to heaven, but I was hedging my bets at VBS. A preacher and a teacher.
That is a track called VBS from the new Lucy Dacus record Home Video, her third studio album. Lucy Dacus, a child of Richmond, Virginia. And she sort of fell backwards into her recording career, wasn't really thinking about becoming a recording artist, was sort of writing songs for fun, helped out a friend with a school project, ended up putting out a record as a result of that called No Burden that filtered out into the internet and became a sensation. Like 20 labels were interested in signing this artist based on a couple of songs
she was
on the internet.
She was going to go to school and make movies.
Yes.
And this music thing was just on the side.
Exactly. And then that turned into something because Matador signed her and then put out the second record in 2018 called Historian, which sort of upped the production values and was widely praised as one of the best albums of that particular year. As if that wasn't a good enough year for Lucy Dacus, she got together with a couple of pals who happened to be named Julian Baker and Phoebe Bridgers, only the three of the best songwriters of the last decade, teaming up for a little side project they call Boy Genius. They released an EP in 2018 that was so good it made my top 10 that year. Home Video, this was a record that was in the works. Apparently she was ready to release it last year, but COVID put that all on hold. She made the record basically with her band. Her previous record was produced by John Congleton. This was sort of an interior project with she and her band working in isolation, creating this record, and now it's finally here. Here's a track from it called First Time from Lucy Dacus' Home Video on Sound Opinion.
That is First Time from Home Video by Lucy Dacus, an extraordinary album, Greg. It's a concept record. This is a Bildungsroman. Think of it as a young woman growing up as a teenager in conservative Richmond. She is from a conservative Christian family. VBS, which we bumped in with, is for Vacation Bible School. And she is questioning the narrow-mindedness of many of the people around her. She is questioning her sexuality. Many of the songs are set in her high school years. She's coming of age. She's wondering where she fits in the world, as many people do in high school. She has friends who are treated wrong by boyfriends and or fathers. The song Thumbs is atypical musically in that it's such a hushed song. But everyone is talking about that tune. She is accompanying a friend who is going to meet the father she hasn't seen since she was 5 years old, now high school age. And you know, Lucy is telling her, you know, I would kill him for you. I would kill him, right?
And then she imagines how she would do it.
Yeah, she would do it quick and easy, but she would do it.
I would kill him quick and easy. Your nails are digging into my knee. I don't know how you keep smiling.
You know, there are those kind of really poignant novelistic eye for detail and storytelling and just fascinating. But I don't want to short the music. She does not have a fantastic voice, but she has a sense for dynamics that I think I haven't heard anybody use dynamics so well since like the early days of Galaxy 500. You know, lyrically, musically, it's just a fantastic album that I can't stop listening to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's brilliant. She's one of the best songwriters we have. I remember seeing her soon after the first record came out at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, the music conference. I was struck not only by the level of songwriting, because I knew she was a serious songwriter, but just how relatable she was on stage. Just such a warm, down-to-earth, funny personality. Yeah. People don't realize how funny she is. The sense of humor that sort of bubbles beneath the surface of a lot of these songs. You know, I'm thinking of a song like Brando, which I think is absolutely brilliant. Yeah. A pop song. I mean, Taylor Swift would love that song.
Right. Well, and she's putting down a boy who thinks he's Brando.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she's kind of had this boyfriend who's trying to seduce her and court her. And she says, "You called me cerebral. Would it kill you to call me pretty instead?"
I'm in a second story window and you're yelling at me still.
You know, and it's kind of like, okay.
Meanwhile, she's not even sure she likes boys.
No, no. She, you know, that's part of this album, too. Her, you know, admission that, you know, she is living a life that's considered a lie, you know, in her church. You know, it's like, you can't do that. You know, it's not allowed.
Yeah.
And, you know, being bisexual is a sin. And she's going, well, wait a minute. This is the way I feel.
Yeah.
So she's wrestling with all these notions. There's a quote that she gave that I really like. "I wanted to visualize the moment when you first reflect on your childhood, which I think can also be the moment the childhood is over." Mm. So she came back to Richmond for her first tour and realized everything's changed. Everybody looks at me differently now. Now I'm, and Richmond has changed for me too. I kind of realized these things that I've been carrying around from my childhood. So, you know, this is a very nuanced record in the way she's looking at it. It's not self-pitying. Her voice is pretty deadpan. She's not histrionic at all. But these songs have a way of devastating you. Like, she jumps from kind of like everyday details, and then she'll kill you with a line. They go, whoa, where did that come from? Like, in that song Thumbs, which is, it just sends a chill up my spine every time I hear it. It's so good about accompanying this friend to meet, as you said, her you know, deadbeat dad. And you know, her feelings about that subject. So, a brilliant songwriter who just keeps getting better with each record. What do you think of the latest from Salt and Lucy Dacus? We're both pretty enthused, but we want to know what your opinions are. Tell them to us on our Facebook group or in our Patreon community. Or you can leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, our conversation with artist Dawn Richard on Sound Opinions.
We still got a lot.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
So much a drip like me.
And we're back. That's a little bit of music from our guest this week, singer and songwriter Dawn Richard. Earlier this year, Dawn released her latest solo album, Second Line, a record both Greg and I loved, and we gave it glowing reviews, Mr. Cotton.
That's right, Jim. And as a solo artist, Dawn's been innovatively blending genres like pop, electronic music, and R&B. And she does that more than ever on Second Line. In many ways, it's kind of a futuristic album. You know, Sun Ra would appreciate this record, Janelle Monáe. But it's also a love letter to her home, New Orleans, and to her mother.
We caught up with Dawn and had a wonderful time talking with her, discussing her unusual musical career trajectory, which began, believe it or not, as a member of the Diddy-constructed girl group Daddy Kane, made for television like the Monkees, Greg, and has led to where she is now, an independent artist making music on her terms alone.
Dawn, I got to ask you, because your parents have been such a big part of your life, obviously, and these last two records have focused on them. I love hearing your mother's voice on Second Life.
Thank you.
And Dad was a big part of the previous one, right? I mean, what they represented in your life, that's quite a tribute. So what is it about your parents?
You know what is crazy? It's not just that they were influential for me, but New Orleans is a small city. They were influential to the city. Both of my parents are educators, so they literally have taught about 60% of New Orleans just off of education alone. Like, they both are elementary teachers. My dad taught music to all the elementary school education children, and my mom's like taught all the public school students in middle school to kindergarten to middle school. So a lot of that relationship was there. And then my father and my mom also, my mom owned the dancing school, and my dad is still in the band Chocolate Milk. So till this day on the radio station, they still play Groove City, which is like an anthem in New Orleans that they play literally. They still play Jazz Fest.
Be what you wanna be.
So the actual Richard name has just been so, you know, crucial to New Orleans. Even when we lost it and we were homeless, to come back, the name is still so like present in the city. So it made so much sense for them to be a part of my, you know, my creative process, especially with these last two albums, because we moved back to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And on the 10-year anniversary of Katrina, both my parents decided, look, we've been without friends, without food, without culture long enough, let's go back home. And that entire introduction back home, me meeting the Mardi Gras Indians again, you know, with New Breed and introducing Chief David Montana, the Ouachita Nation on that album, using my dad's band as a lot of the samples for the album, and then having my mom speak about her side of the family, the New Iberia Cajun country part of her side. It really just shows you guys that it's not just about the city, but me as a survivor. I think my survival in the music industry is hugely a part of the fact that I'm bred from two survivors that come from a city that's known to have to be a survival city. So it just makes sense that my entire story would bleed together with my parents.
Yeah, that does make sense. I was reading an interview with you where you're talking about the fact that your parents, you had no illusions about what you were getting into when you got into the music business because of what your parents were already telling you.
Yeah, my dad painted a beautiful, ugly picture. He did. He was not shy about telling me. He was signed to RCA. He was with Alan Toussaint. Like, my dad had a struggle, and he was in a band. And so there were a lot of opinions, you know, and a lot of times everyone who can experience a band knows that a lot of times they don't stay together. And whatever reasons, percentages and publishing and all those things, the nasty things that you don't think most people go through when they think about being an artist, they were very real for my father. My mom was like, you're not going to sing anymore because you're making $10 on a song and that's just not going to cut it. My dad was, you know, not really feeling the way the band was treated, how they were like being told they had to conform to the sounds of what the 70s was at the time. So I knew all of this coming into it. Nobody was like, yay, music, when I decided to make this journey. If anything, my mom was like, God, oh my goodness.
Not you too.
Yeah, like not you too. Exactly. That's exactly what she was like. And my dad was just kind of like upfront, you know, and he knew it was going to be a struggle. So even when I started my career, I knew it was going to be rough, you know, and even with that idea, it's still, nobody could prepare me for the trajectory that I've had as an artist. It's just severely unconventional, my entire journey.
It truly is. It's almost like you did it in reverse. You know, you start with like one of the biggest names in the whole industry at the time, with Puff Daddy being involved in your career early on. And then you went independent like 10 years later. You know, it's kind of like a really kind of weird, unconventional trajectory. Like, after having that experience and things don't exactly work out 100%, a lot of people would just kind of you know, give up at that point. Like, okay, I'm going to go try, you know, accounting or something like that. But you kept going. But what is it that kept you going? What you said, okay, I'm going to get cut off from all those budgets and all the, you know, nice clothes that I could wear and, you know, all the mentorship that I get from a guy who's really connected to doing it on your own. That's a tough transition, right? And yet you went for it.
Yeah. It was rough, you know. Budgets that were, when you think about the definition of a manufactured artist, especially in that time, 2005, where pop, you know, the pop aesthetic was severely manufactured from the major labels to the budget. They gave you the blueprint to a reality TV show. There was just no other, like, I was groomed into something that was as manufactured and as machine as you could possibly be.
Good morning, MTV. It's your boy Diddy. And we are back. We have to finish where we started. We're gonna make an album. We're gonna sell millions of records. Shoot hot videos, and you're gonna love them. If it was only that easy.
So I was thrusted into the budgets, and then I went from that to being in a group with my boss. So it went from 60% to 1,000,000,000%, because, you know, yeah, like the levels of that, right? It went from, you know, to have an Atlantic and Bad Boy to Interscope, Jimmy Iovine and Puff. So two mega superstars coming together, and then to have none of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very different thing for me. But I also, again, speaking to what New Orleans is to me, we are built to survive. I had been homeless prior. I had lived in a car. So the idea of a struggle is something that I'm very familiar with. There was no mindset to not continue. There was no other fallback, or we don't have those things here in New Orleans. What you create for yourself is all you have. My mom and dad were 50 years old, and they lost everything in Katrina. Everything. Mm. They had no birth certificates, down to the birth certificate. So to watch them figure out how to then survive again and take their children with them to figure it out, I better figure it out too. If they can do it, if my peers can do it, if I've lost my family members along the way that did it in Katrina, all those people that have done it, that's kind of how I took my career, in the same kind of tenacity. It's like, there is no fallback. I got to keep continuing because I have no other choice. And that became kind of like the ammunition I needed as an independent artist. And you're right, the budgets left, the people left. There was all the people that was around during the studio, all the big names, they were gone. Those guys were, it looked like a tumbleweed was going, you know, like the tumbleweed. It was like all that left, and I had to get really familiar with the DIY scene. The good thing about that is, though, that was my love of music as a young person. I grew up on alt rock, on you know, electronic dance. So like from Cage Choice to Biff Naked to Bjork to Portishead to Soundgarden, I loved those kinds of models. Green Day was my first concert. So like the idea of a cult following and building from the ground up was something that was fine for me, because that's what I loved growing up. So I had to start from scratch, and that's what I did. The last 8 years, I built it from the ground up.
Bring the beat. She been into it like she get in the heat. Sound system like a wave, she rocked in the heat. Southern girls do it better, you take the feet. Setting up a pounce hustle, you take a seat. Buzz it for me. Buzz it for me. Buzz it for me. Buzz it for me.
You know, I think your attitude is inspiring, Dawn. There's very few musicians who would have had the limo and the catering and all of that, and then it pulls away, and who wouldn't be standing there crying. Here's the thing that I don't get, because in some interviews I've heard you say, you know, they would say to us, show more skin. You know, you're too fat. You know, all of that. Now, this is what doesn't compute, because I know on TV you played the optimistic go along, get along. Nobody was thrown. You were not thrown, right? But I don't know. I get this sense from your music that there were times where you had a string of curse words for those people who were going to tell you how to dress.
Yeah, but also my father gave me ammunition to understand this business. I still had a degree in marketing. I still had came from, so there was a, it was a bigger game afoot, right? So like I also understood I had no, like, nobody from New Orleans had ever been on television. No girl, especially, you know, all we had was Lil Wayne. We had hip hop, right? Yeah. We didn't have a pop girl that was an example. So I was on this television show where you would never have thought a girl from the Night Ward would be on a pop television show that was popular. And I'm going to sit up and talk to Diddy on top of that being a black woman, where at that time, you're only the angry black, the Omarosa, like at that time, when you think about what the black woman was, we didn't have, I was grateful to be there. And I was like, I have to play this so smart. So yeah, those curse words were there, but it was bigger than just my personal ego. It was, I had New Orleans on my shoulders because no one had made it that far. The closest girl in pop that was from our vicinity was Britney Spears, Kentwood, Louisiana.
Think about that.
Yeah. And that's a white girl. Right.
That's so a like, whole other world. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a whole other world. So I couldn't fumble. So the coming from nothing and then getting this massive opportunity and knowing that, like, yo, you, that I'd never been in front of cameras like that. There was, you know, with Puff giving you a shot. And then when we came back, I lost everything. So when I came back to the show before you picked the band, I was homeless. So the curse words was like secondary to the reality that I had to give my parents a home. Yeah. We were living on the floor and in a car. So like that attitude was secondary to the bigger scheme of things.
Yeah, I just meant in the terms of telling you what to do. I mean, you have said loud and proud, I am the genre.
Well, that's what that came from. That's what that came from, right? So 10 years of holding my tongue, being stifled, 10 years of being told what to wear, how to wear my hair.
Yeah.
Like literally a man saying, you have to wear this because I have to wear this. And me being quiet for 10 years, as soon as I got free, I promised myself if I was going to be building my own sets before the show, sewing my own costumes, you know, producing these own records, then, yeah, I am going to be really cocky and loose mouth with what I'm going to say because I deserve that. I paid 10 years of dues for it.
Oh, baby, you're down bad, you're mad at him. My briefcase is leaving the trails at your feet. Bounce the bounce, hit the rubble on the limb. This is like my line, baby, down. Move your feet. Move your feet. Move your feet, my interludes is better than all your EPs. Took the beat. This could never be a me.
I don't need a genre. I am the genre.
You know, we have interviewed Mac McCaughan and Laura Balance, founders of Merge, and obviously we've covered them for years.
I love them so much. Right,
tell me about the first time you sit with those two. Here's the Danity Kane girl who now has a solo. I mean, you have large solo catalog, but even that, I mean, it is such an unexpected move for them and such an unexpected move for you, and it worked out so perfectly on Second Line.
So
I'm
good.
Just wondering about what that first chat was like.
It was wild, right? Because I spoke to my manager, Dan, at the time, because I hadn't had a manager either. I had horrible, horrible stories about management. So I, like, serious. Like, one manager told me we wouldn't make it unless I dated him. Like, serious levels of, like, crazy. Ooh. Like, just crazy. So I stayed away for a while. And then I met Dan, and he was like, I think you should try Merge. And I did the research, because I had been looking into Loma Vista, Domino. I knew I needed to go alt.
Yeah.
Because I had I wasn't being received as a black woman in my own space. Mm. Culturally, black artists aren't represented in black labels. We aren't like our sound.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like electronic dance, heavy metal, there are not a lot of all black heavy metal labels,
no,
right? So
you, no.
we have to get creative,
yeah.
right? So I knew I had to go alt, but I hadn't figured it out yet. And I met with them. And at first I looked at the roster and I was like, man, I don't know if this is a smart play because there aren't a lot of people of color. But their roster was so amazing, and it was so with everything that I loved, from Destroyer to Arcade Fire to Caribou, who I love.
Yeah.
I follow Caribou forever. And then we talked, and I just loved. I loved every. They said, "I see you. We love what you're doing. We don't want to change you. We understand your message." Because I told them that I wanted to uplift black women in a space that we weren't seen in, especially in electronic. And they said, okay, let's go. Where do we go from here? And the acceptance was so massive, guys. You have to understand, I'd been 10 years on a major label and I never had the acceptance or the belief in my art that I had with this crew. So color became secondary, them not having a people of color, that was so out of, I was like, okay, fine, that I can't like not see them, because the acceptance of like them saying, no, we get you and we're behind you, and the proof constantly that they've showed up for is, I've never been treated like this as an artist, and I am so grateful that we both took the risk, because I think this merge for lack of a better, you know, for like being, you know, attention.
Yeah, that's a good pun.
But this merger, like, was beneficial for both of us in a way that I think will change the way, like, artists and labels understand artists. Like, they won't just choose based off of what they conventionally think an artist should be. I was definitely not on their roster, but it was the best thing we could have ever done, because now I sit in a space that I think they never thought they could have, like, pushed, and they've done it beautifully, like beautifully. And same here, I never would have thought I would have lived on a label where Destroyer lived.
Yeah.
And do well, and yet here I am.
Well, I just always am tripping on the idea of Dawn Richard compared to a Neutral Milk Hotel.
Yeah.
You know? But really, you know, two visionary artists that wouldn't have fit anywhere else.
I think Merge is a home for Merge will be revolutionary. They are going to be the blueprint of how labels, especially indie labels, should start taking risk on just different types of artists that never would have, you know, you never would think that they would make sense together. I think this was such a beautiful marriage, and I don't never want to leave now. Like, they're stuck with me. They're so stuck with me, because I just think they understand. They understand what I'm trying to do, and I think it's bigger than just what genre you're in. It's about the message. I think Merge cares about the message. They're making great artists, and they're supporting great artists.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Dawn Richard. We're going to talk about how she's grown into being such a talented producer and how she creates cinematic stories with her music. That's next on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we are back. This week we are talking with artist Dawn Richard. Let's get back to our conversation.
You know, I think in a lot of ways, Dawn, you've been waging war for the last 10 years on the whole multiple stereotypes. You know, first of all, New Orleans music is this. We know what that's Iko Iko,
and
that's
that.
Dr. John, and, you know, this sound from the 60s. And you're a black artist doing different, kind of weird, different, you're alternative R&B. And, you know, that's the genre you get put in if you're kind of a quirky, different sounding black woman in music. You know, coming from a background where Puff Daddy is like, talk about creating, you know, defining people. You're like, I'm not defining anything here. I'm redefining it in my image. So
yeah.
That's a huge leap on multiple levels on your part. And that takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, but I think it's important, you know. But I've been, like you said, I think you nailed it, and you guys are seeing me. I've been fighting my whole life, right? You know, long before music, but just in general as a Black woman, constantly never really fitting in. Like, I loved anime growing up. I loved rock music. I'm from the South, but that's fine. I could be from the Lower Ninth Ward and Green Day be my first concert, but that meant I was an outlier always. So this wasn't something that just kind of came up. I've always been familiar with kind of fighting to be who I saw myself to be. And I think the biggest thing that I realized in my career was a lot of times, even with being with Puff, I was being told what I needed to be in order to be successful. And I never ever saw myself as the thing that I kept being defined as. So it was important for me this time around to be unapologetically, if I did get this shot, because I knew it was a far cry, because I knew the moment I did my solo music the way I wanted to do it, I was already told if I went this route, I would fail. I asked Puff to sign me. I asked the major labels when Dirty Money was finished. I said, I'll stay with you if you support me with this sound. And they told me, if you make this music, we won't sign you. And wow. So I knew this was going to be a risk. But I felt like if I failed, it should be on my terms. And what I chose then, and what I realized, I never knew my race would dictate my sound. Huh. I never thought that that would dictate what I would be until I was told. I was in a predominantly white girl group writing the music, and we were making hits. The moment the white girls left and I was singing the same songs, they weren't pop hits anymore. That's a wild concept. Think about that. Like, I was in a group where I was making the records and writing with them, but the moment my face was on the same songs, they weren't considered as dope anymore. Mm. And then I got with my boss, who is the biggest person of all time, and our album wasn't successful. And so he quit on it because he had a vision. We had all these amazing people in it. So twice my career was totally dismantled without my power. Like, I just had to watch my career. So it was important for me that if I was gonna fight, it was on my terms. And that, you're right, as I got through my projects, I realized, damn, my race is really dictating how people see me.
I feel the pressure. Pressure when you feel the pressure. When I'm running to you, feel the pressure. Feel the pressure when you, I feel you.
Especially with Second Line, I did realize when you look at electronic genre, a genre that came from Detroit.
Yeah.
House music, Detroit, yeah. Chicago, yeah. New Jersey. Yeah. It was very Black. House music, dance music was Black. Ballroom culture, Black, has now been infiltrated by, if you look at any award show, any nominations, it's white DJs. Not even, it's some producers, but mostly it's DJs with featured artists singing on it. So an artist like me, I've got to fight twice as hard, because if I'm not a DJ and I'm not a producer that has features, if I'm just the actual artist producing the stuff as well as singing it and doing dance, you know, dancing in the A count, I'm now not that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I made this point when we reviewed the record a while back on the show, that I think you are one of the most revolutionary producers. It has nothing to do with, I'm going to compare you to a Black woman, since Missy Elliott, right?
Wow.
So talk to me about your approach as a producer. How do you run your studio? How do you work with your collaborators? You know, what's the Brian Eno stuff you're doing at the mixing desk?
Yeah, so for me, I've always loved sound design. That's mixing and sequencing has been the journey for me. And every time I collab, I never perform or work with the same producers twice, ever. So each project has had a different, you know, like someone that nobody knows, I get in and I say, okay, we're going to build this from the ground up. And whether it's analog, Omnisphere, whether we go with Moog or we do it with live sound, timpanies, or whatever we have to do, it's built by myself with that other producer. I never work with more than 3 to 4 people, mm-hmm. because I think it's important that I have a sound first. Mm-hmm. No matter what the album is, you know it's my sound as soon as you hear it. With this project, I work with the incredible Ela Orbis, Black Kid. We did it in a motel, like in a dirty motel.
You rented a motel?
No, he lived in the motel. He lived in the motel. Wow. And I visited him and I was like, oh my, and he made it so cozy and so fly. But from the outside, it looked like you might, the Bates Hotel, like from outside, it looked like you might get stabbed. It was really the coolest experience. And he's a young guy. And he had never been pushed like this before. And it was important that I knew coming into it, sequencing was going to be imperative because we're going to be putting a lot of genres together. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to a lot of Larry Heard. I knew that I wanted to incorporate, house, so I had to listen to the greats. I listened to Daft Punk. I listened to Hans Zimmer as far as scoring the Blade Runner soundtrack. I knew that I wanted something that embodied New Orleans, but didn't sound like New Orleans, because the story is New Orleans, but this is the possibilities. This is the future. So it won't be anything you've heard before. So you can't, people were expecting brass bands. And I was like, no, I actually defined it by listening to the BPMs of brass bands, of second lines, and applying the BPM and the cadence, but then making it sound completely different. Yeah. So never taking it literally.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what and I do that with every project, is how do I create something that hasn't been done before? Take, pay homage, but figure out how to manipulate it so that it has a new journey to it. And this album was so much fun to make because of that.
Well, I love it. And but let me, we're two music critics, Dawn, right? So we always have something to grouse about. Let me ask you, because I've never been able to, I am always thrown by what, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call skits, right? I love your mom, right? I would sit and listen to her talk for 4 hours, okay?
Yeah.
But the one thing about Second Line, I had to make my own playlist because I get tired of King Creole.
Have you ever been to a Second Line?
Oh, yes, indeed.
I get tired of Selfish Outro, right? Parts of it, or Voodoo, The Outer Mission, right? And I want the play. I don't want the ride to be derailed, right? So I'm asking, as an artistic decision, when you decide to put in these interludes between songs, what is the thinking? How would you defend that for me being an ignorant jerk?
Well, it's not an ignorant jerk. I think that's what's part of the art, right? Some people will like it, some people don't. It's not just a sonic experience for me, it's visual. Mm. So I'm applying something beyond just your ears, right? Voodoo Outro wasn't there for you sonically. It was there for me visually when I'm creating the 8 count for Live, when I'm creating the music video for that's about to come out for the Voodoo Outro, right? Selfish is an introduction into the next album. So it's not there, right? It's not there for you now.
You are thinking
it's
big.
It's there for you
always,
later.
Always, right. Okay.
Always, right? That's okay that, just like I have, since the beginning of my career, interludes has been the most fun thing to create. Mm. And if you check my trajectory, most of the time my interludes are better than half the songs I write. And people hate me for it because they're like, why is this not a song? And I love that because, again, I feel like it pushes. When I used to read literature, one of my favorite things I love about my grandmother, she had a PhD in library science. I used to live in the library. I used to love when I would be reading a chapter, and one chapter would be like 2 pages, and it'd be one of the best chapters, and I'd be like, why did they do this? And I always wanted to be like that as a writer. So a lot of times they're eggs. They're hidden eggs in a video game where maybe one level is easier to do than all the other levels, and they're put there as moments for not everybody. Those are the connoisseurs who appreciate maybe they like that Voodoo interlude because visually that's one of their favorite music videos, or that's one of their favorite experiences. So yeah, you're right. It's going to be like that all the time.
So you don't mind awesome. You don't mind if people make a playlist and enter it. But yet you're still old fashioned in a way, in that you are creating, just like, Yes or Genesis did, a movie on an album, right?
You got it. And that's one of my favorite albums, by the way. But that's the point. How do I give you New Orleans in the future if I can't give you a visual to go with it? Okay. Because no one's ever seen New Orleans like that or even heard it. I've got to give you longer experiences because they have not even really. Some people are going to be like, this don't sound like New Orleans. Right, because you've never seen Blade Runner in New Orleans. You've just never seen that, right? So I'm trying to create a sci-fi experience in a place that you're still dated to see it in the 70s and 60s, like you guys said. So sometimes I've got to elongate and shorten and maneuver it because I'm not just giving you something you put on your headphones. It's something that I've got to take you to a world you've never been to.
Well, I Jim and I argued about this on the show because I loved hearing your mother's voice.
I love
and
her mother.
You know what?
Give mom. Hey, Mac McCorn, give mom a solo album.
No, right? mom contextualizes the songs for me.
Like, what does it mean to love a Louisiana woman, a girl?
Oh, my God. You have to be willing to...
You gotta be ready.
You gotta be willing to take it like she give it to you. I mean, she's gonna tell you what she feels. She's gonna be honest with you. She's not going to back down. She will not back down. They'll tell you, they say, don't mess with a Louisiana girl.
What I loved about it was that I'm listening to an album. You're taking me on a journey. And and it's meant, like, listen to this sequentially, dude. You're not supposed to pick this apart. You're supposed to listen to the whole thing in one sitting. So I think, first of all, who's thinking like that anymore? You know, it's like it's sort of a lost concept. But I love the idea that we're thinking in terms of, yeah, people will sit down for 35 or 40 minutes and listen to this thing beginning to end. I trust my
and
audience.
It's tone, too. I also wanted to play with, if you guys listen to both of us, similar tones. There's a lot of similarities in my mom, right? So there's this level of, it's even just a tonal conversation being between the two of us, and kind of like that play too, like they're damn near the same person, you know, like it's a play happening that's, you know, like that's pushing you beyond just, you know, hearing my mom talk, you know. Mm-hmm. And then her and I have had a very turbulent relationship, so the fact that we could even sit down and have that discussion was powerful in itself. So there were a lot of underliers there that I didn't want to blatantly say, that was more for ambiance. That's deeper for those who appreciate the layers.
Wow, that's great. You know, and you mentioned something about the futurist aspect, you know, Afrofuturism. I figured that out, like that 2016 Redemption album, the album cover. I mean, that's Sun Ra, man. It's like, okay.
Sun Ra.
I get her. I understand what she's up to. So that is a big part of this too, the sort of the idea that there's, and that's been a huge thread through Black music history. For decades.
Especially, you know, in New Orleans, especially in blues and cities like New Orleans. Absolutely. And I'm so glad you caught the Sun Ra. And even the idea of taking the Mardi Gras Indian headdress and then making it metal.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Like, right? And then on New Breed, actually wearing a chief headdress, which is almost taboo because no woman should ever wear.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they say, but just doing it while basking in the sun, like as if it's an everyday thing.
Right.
That in itself, right, is again, this constant ideas of what the future could be, mm-hmm, and playing it off of every cover. And then to design King Creole as a half android, half human, as a Black, you know, animated character on a cover with the Mardi Gras Indian feather on it is just, again, a play on the Afrofuturist story and how it's been a part of Black culture for a very long time. And we've never really had the discussion beyond our own little sub-genre moments, but how it hasn't taken its place in sci-fi the way I feel that it should, right, on a mainstream level.
That's because you got to go back to your first love and do the anime feature version of this album.
Exactly.
I've seen you,
which is a whole other work.
I know. I've seen you say in interviews you want to do your own studio.
I do, and it's working with, again, my being a creative director with Adult Swim, that has been the fun part, is finding all these incredible Black animators and working with them and making this content that creates that, so you can see more of our faces, not just behind the scenes, but on the actual camera. Because I would die if I could see a Black version of, Running Man or Blade Runner, or like, you know, like seriously, or even just have more Black faces within that space, because it's, you know, like a Black Metropolis. So good, like just really push with the ideas of seeing Black people in android form, like Ghost in the Shell, and really pushing for that. That could be really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a fascinating, multifaceted career you've built for yourself, Don, and congratulations on the record.
It has been a joy talking to you, Don. Thank you so
much. I love you guys. I appreciate you.
That wraps up our conversation with Dawn Richard, and as always, we want to hear from you. Who are some of your favorite genre-blending artists a la Dawn Richard? Leave a voice message with your opinions at our website, soundopinions.org.
Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to dig deep for some buried treasures that are flying beneath the mainstream radar, and we're also interviewing another artist who sometimes flies beneath the mainstream radar but has made some really innovative music over the last couple decades, Damon Locks.
I'm glad Damon's finally getting some well-deserved attention, Greg. Starting today, listeners, you can participate in our Sound Opinion Survey that is going to help us focus our resources and make the show more sustainable, help us learn more about how to serve you, our listeners. It'll be open until July 31. To take the survey, go to soundopinions.org. The link is on our homepage.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our intern, Sol Delgadillo, as well as our social media consultant, Katie Cotton.